This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm going to introduce what the project is and the context and try to justify why we're doing what we're doing in less than 2 minutes. And then Ben will walk you through what we have done. So basically, Steve, in his presentation, talked about narrative and the difference, and the question came up from Clark about framing. This is a framing study. It's a media study, and we'll explain the depth of that in a minute. But the argument we're making is we want to look at how the media frames the question of terrorism and terrorist organizations. And so we're looking at how this is done. As you'll see, it's specifically is concentrated on Al-Qaeda. We have it a long period of time. And the argument that we have is comes out of communication and media studies in terms of how framing operates in particular sectors. And one of the things we find, and I'm not going to bore you with all the comm theory for those outside the field, but the argument that has been made and tested quite nicely over the years is that when there is consensus among policy elites about policy and particularly in terms of the definition of the situation, the media tends to reflect that presentation for in terms of what they talk about. And it's only in the period when policy elites start to disagree that the media represents that disagreement. This is called indexing theory. It holds up very well in both the United States and the UK over time on various functions, but it holds up really, really well, and particularly well, and anything that has to do with national security. The normal rally around the flag kinds of arguments hold, but in general, the definition of this of the situation under national security situations, until the elite disagrees, there is a general coherence about the way that the media presents. And there's some very good reasons for that. And one way of looking at Bennett talks about the fact that there are four built-in biases about the way that the media operates as sort of just traditional journalistic practice. The first thing is the personalization of the story. So we're all familiar with, you tell the story not in terms of big structure, but rather in through the eyes of a victim, a particular person, how it affects mom and pop, as opposed to what are the statistics on poverty, for example. Secondly, the media journalists are taught to dramatize. So the good notion of what a good story is a typical strategy of narrative, a beginning, middle, to an end, as a dramatis personae, and you tell the story. It's not to create fiction, but rather it has the same principles of a good story. The third is that the media tends to fragmentize, so that stories are told in and of themselves with only, and particularly episodic stories about events in terms of the context of that event at that moment, and it's only after a time that we get to any kind of thematic and contextual kind of story, and it has to be a really big story for that to develop. And finally, the media has a tendency, because of the journalistic practice we're all familiar with, and particularly important in national security or any kind of crime situation, disaster, is what Bennett calls the authority disorder, which means that to get the story, the first thing you do is you go to the person in charge, okay, whether it's the sheriff or the police chief, and obviously on huge stories, the president, the secretary of state, the defense, whoever that is, and that is the initial quote that frames the story and starts the process, which, of course, keeps that frame being contextualized in terms of the way that the policy elites see the story. So as a result, we can assume, just for the moment for practice, that the media representations are a reasonable, but not perfect, a reasonable representation of how policy elites are defining the situation. And so this may explain the earlier comment that we as scholars have failed to convince people that the appropriate way to look at terrorism is this way or that way, because, of course, We're not the ones framing the story. Someone else is, and they have a bit more power. So with that, I'm going to introduce Ben Smith, who is going to take you through the study.
Thank you so much. And I think you just stole my notes. Yeah. Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about today is actually the combined results of three different lines of research. In the first line of research, we are exploring the landscape of media terrorism discourse. We're looking very broadly over the span of 18 years at the discourse in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times discussing terrorism and terrorist events. One of the key findings of that was, foreshadow here, is that Al-Qaeda is a primary reference for understanding global terrorism. And the reason that's important is because that actually leads into the second thing that we'll be discussing, which is specifically, as the referent, how do we discuss Al-Qaeda? How is Al-Qaeda framed? So that will be the second part of what I'll be presenting on. And then the third part is an extension of that. As the referent, Al-Qaeda, we've noticed, also is used to frame other organizations. It's used to define the actions and the attributes of those organizations. So we'll be concluding with a brief look at that and discussing in some small detail about the implications of that discursive practice. So the first thing I want to... that's a slide I was supposed to have up for that, but whatever. The first thing I want to look at is what exactly was this, the body of text? What is it that we're looking at? So we have developed over at the Orfalea Center a database of newspaper articles. It's close to 110,000 newspaper articles covering an 18-year time span, specifically from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And these are all articles that either mention terrorism or mention a specific terrorist actor. So some are more relevant than others, of course, but this is the raw database that we have to work with. And from that, for each of the different studies, we've been subsampling from this very large database specific parts of it to explore different questions. Now, the first thing we're going to be exploring is specifically just what is that media landscape. For that particular part of the study, we did it rather narrow. What we did is we looked at, for each of the articles, the organizations tagged the articles with what they consider the subject to be. One of those options is terrorism. So we looked specifically at, over that 18-year time span, all of the newspaper articles that were specifically tagged with the subject of terrorism. And then we decided, let's look and see what organizations are being mentioned in these articles. What is the distribution of those mentions? And this is what we found. We found, when you look at the frequency of articles mentioning a particular organization, these are organizations that were identified by the State Department as terrorist organizations. What we end up finding is that you kind of get a very strange distribution. It's not exactly what we expected to see here. What you would expect to see from a pure, nominal perspective is that, Al-Qaeda is probably going to have a lot more newspaper mentions than most other organizations, primarily due to 9/11. But that the rest of the organizations should, relatively speaking, be flat. They should be somewhat approaching just even, right? So more flat. And what you see here is that this is actually a log-log graph. And what it's showing us is actually something called a Zipfian distribution, which is a special class of a power law distribution, which is really interesting in as much as why Zipfian distributions exist. A Zipfian distribution actually talks about the way we talk, the way language, all language, and this has been tested over hundreds of different languages, they all follow Zipfian distributions, which basically says that the most commonly used word will be used twice as much as the next commonly used word, which is twice as much as the next, twice a log-log distribution like what we see right here. And the reason it's very interesting that it's following this type of distribution is not because the distribution is interesting. It's kind of boring. I mean, who likes talking about, statistical distributions? No, what's interesting is why it works, why a Zipfian distribution exists across so many different languages. And it's this idea of the principle of least effort. Now, what this is basically saying is that complex language, I'm just going to read this here, complex language has evolved to be as efficient as possible, and Zipf's law is the natural outcome of the non-trivial arrangement of word-concept associations adopted for complying with hearer and speaker needs. Language has evolved in order to balance the needs of me, the speaker, and the needs of you, the listener. And what this implies that it is cognitively easier to use a highly symbolic word, a word that can be used in many different contexts, that it can be imbued with additional meaning. It's easier to use those frequently than it is to use words that have less symbolic meaning, that are more precise words. And so those symbolic words are used for, are now absolutely necessary for sharing meaning between individuals. So what does that mean about terrorism? So we know that it covers, we know that there is a Zipfian distribution when it comes to organizations. We know that's not really what you should expect to see, but we know why a Zipfian distribution occurs in the first place. And so we can make a couple of assumptions. First, we can inherently assume that Al-Qaeda is a more symbolically meaningful organization than all the other terror organizations in the last 18 years, because it is the baseline for that distribution. And just like with word, with natural language, the words that are used most frequently are those that are the most symbolically meaningful. I mean, what? The, is, I. One of the really cool things about the word the, is that it's applied to so many different contexts. And it, the fact that it has a very strong inherent meaning, but it's a symbolic meaning, it's not a precise meaning. It's a meaning that can be altered for the context. It's a very alterable meaning, right? So that's important. And what this implies is that Al-Qaeda will and has been used to characterize less frequently mentioned terrorist organizations, just like the word the. The is used to characterize nouns, right? And so what this implies, just on its own, and this is just an implication, but I'm about to prove it, is that Al-Qaeda has been used to characterize less frequently mentioned terrorist organizations. So let's look at a graph that proves it. This is the conditional probability of co-occurrence between Al-Qaeda and Organization X. And what that means is, if Organization X, Hamas, or Daesh, or any other organization, if they're mentioned in a news article, what's the probability that Al-Qaeda is also going to show up? Not the reverse, not what's the probability if Al-Qaeda shows up that these show up, just if this organization is mentioned, what is the probability that Al-Qaeda shows up in that article? And what that can kind of get us to is this idea that it's showing up as a way to explain. It's showing up as a way to explain the other organization, or to contrast, or from this type of analysis, we can't say the precise. We'll get to that in a bit. But what we can say is that that what we see here is something really stark. And what we're actually seeing is that of the 53 different terrorist organizations that actually have mentions in our database, not all of the official state-designated terrorist organizations are actually mentioned in any of these news articles. But of those that are, 29 of them have statistically significant co-occurrence coefficients. Those are the red ones. The ones up there at the very top that are the yellow that are still a one, that's a perfect probability. It's because there's like three mentions and you can't tell if it's statistically significant if it's only been mentioned three times. But what we see is all these red ones are statistically significant, meaning that those organizations, 29 of the 53 organizations, if they're talked about, it's incredibly likely that Al-Qaeda is talked about as well. So what does just this mean? This is just a very simple, this is a network analysis, just looking very simply at the mentions of organizations. And what it shows is, first, we know that Al-Qaeda is more symbolically meaningful than all the other terrorist organizations in the last 18 years. We know that Al-Qaeda is frequently discussed in connection with lesser-known terrorist organizations. And from that, we can imply, and it can be concluded, that Al-Qaeda is a symbolically meaningful organization specifically used to characterize lesser-known threats. So we take this finding, and we start to explore, and we start to ask a couple of different questions. If that is true, if it is true that Al-Qaeda is a symbolic and meaningful organization, and it's used to characterize lesser-known threats, we need to ask a couple questions. The first question is, okay, how do journalists construct a meaningful understanding of Al-Qaeda and its actions? We need to understand what that looks like. If Al-Qaeda is used as the referent group, we need to know how they're talked about in the first place. Right, and so we're going to be exploring that with a concept called attribute framing, which is specifically a specific type of framing where you're looking at what attributes are applied to them. And we'll talk about that more in just a second. And the other part is, what is the role of Al-Qaeda in the broader terrorism discourse? We know that they are often used in connection with, is often used in connection with other organizations. So what does that look like? How does that act? And so that will be when we look at the use of Al-Qaeda as a framing device. How am I doing on time? Oh, good, great. Okay, article sampling for this for the purpose of this particular set of analyses, we did a more narrow scope as far as the time span is concerned. Instead of looking at the entire 18 years, we focused in specifically on a two-year time span. There's a couple of reasons for that. First, it minimizes the influence of the elections while still capturing the rise of Daesh, which we thought was important when we first started an investigation because we were very interested, theoretically interested in that occurrence. Also, if we had done a much larger time span, it would have been harder to say anything specific because we know for a fact that these things tend to shift over time somewhat, and so we would have lost a lot of the more precise findings that we were able to get just by looking at a two-year time span. The actual articles that we looked at were all the articles in that time span that mention al-Qaeda, and that includes editorials, includes opinion pieces, includes any newspaper article that mentions al-Qaeda. And we did that very specifically because we want to capture not just the journalists, but everything that shows up in that paper, because that includes the popular discourse as well. So we thought that was very important to be able to capture as broadly as possible how are people talking about al-Qaeda and how are they using al-Qaeda as a tool. So I'm going to just step through this really quickly. It's important to understand when we were coding for these articles, this was all hand-coded. This was all people actually reading the articles. We used a constant comparison method, also known as grounded theory, to develop our findings. And there was three basic assumptions that we were using throughout the entire process. The first assumption is that language requires shared meaning. The communication cannot occur unless the meaning of individual words are shared inside of a particular context. If you don't agree on the word context with me, it's really hard to communicate, so I think it's a pretty good assumption. Encoding requires choices. Anytime that you talk about anything, there are usually multiple different words that you can use to describe any particular thing. Those are imbued with additional meaning, though. Each of those words has a slightly different connotation to it or can be imbued with additional meaning, so you are required to make choices between those words that have similar meanings. And we also make the rather strong assumption that the choices are deliberate. And deliberate in as much as they are intended to maximize meaning, not deliberate in that they are conscious necessarily. I don't mean that the journalist is sitting down trying to figure out exactly how to create this master narrative. No, they're deliberate in that they're trying to share meaning as maximally as possible. And again, deliberate, not necessarily conscious. I want to make sure that's clear. So those are the three assumptions we went going for. So let's look at the first research question. And we are not going to be able to explore in depth the full findings. We are actually going to be presenting these. We have other papers that fully explore both research question one and research question two, so I'm just going to be touching on the findings. This is just a quick look at the attribute framing of terrorism. We found that there was four common attribute classes that were talked about in a lot of the different mentions of al-Qaeda. That's their organizational structure, both intra and intra-organizational structure, the functional identity, meaning something like how they actually function, what they actually are functioning to do, and how they are doing it, the motivations that they have, and there's often evaluative judgments there as well. And the evaluative judgments basically saying, what do we think about the actions that are occurring? It's the judgments being imbued. Again, we do not have time to get into the full details of these, so I want to just touch on some of the aspects of the primary framing of al-Qaeda. First of all, al-Qaeda is overwhelmingly framed as an adversarial force motivated by a core ideology. And I want to be clear here, when I say core ideology, we found that it was actually a specific difference between framing them as ideological versus as being framed as an Islamic ideology. They were both present, they were both frequent, but ideology, pure ideology, was actually slightly more common. There's two big things that come from this overarching framing of al-Qaeda. First, implies a singular problem solution, military intervention. By framing them as an adversarial force, it implies that the only way to fight them, and adversarial meaning adversarial as in a militaristic adversarial force, the only way to fight that is through military intervention. And the other part is that, I personally found this somewhat surprising, is that al-Qaeda was often described as being bound by its ideals. And we see this specifically when it talks about contrast with Daesh. In a lot of the articles that were contrasting al-Qaeda or comparing al-Qaeda to Daesh, we noticed that it was very specific that al-Qaeda was often framed as being constricted in its actions by a quote-unquote pure ideology, which is something we actually saw mentioned many times in the newspaper articles, was the phrase pure ideology. And it was used to contrast it against something, specifically Daesh and a couple of other organizations, but predominantly Daesh, as there are certain things that they would not do. Beyond this, the characteristics of al-Qaeda were incredibly fluid. Most other aspects of al-Qaeda, there was not a dominant frame. There was not a dominant way of talking about them, and that implies that there was not a dominant way of understanding them. Instead, it was very fluid, and this is especially true when it came to organizational structure of al-Qaeda, which left untenably amorphous. Often, the choice in how the organizational structure was framed seemed to be more strategic in how to they wanted to paint the picture of al-Qaeda for that particular article, rather than actually having anything to do with what the individuals actually thought the organizational structure was. So it may have been useful to call them to use a franchise-type metaphor rather than a network-type metaphor in any particular instance. Okay, so that was just a very, very brief overview, and I'm sorry that I don't get to go into more detail because I could talk for days on that. And I have. I know, okay. Research question number two, what is the role of al-Qaeda in the broader terrorism discourse? Two big things I want to point out here. First of all, approximately 60% of the time, articles mention al-Qaeda. They were neither the organization primarily being discussed, nor were they the organization whose actions were being described. In both instances, so 60% of the time, there's basically no reason for al-Qaeda to be mentioned. And the other big general takeaway is that al-Qaeda as a frame of device predominantly served to define other organizational actors. There was we identified, I believe, 11 different mechanisms through which this occurred. And I, again, would love to get into that. I'm almost out of time, though, so I'm not going to. So I'm just going to go ahead and skip straight to the conclusions. The biggest conclusion here that I want to hark on is what the issue with this is. What's the problem with this? And it really comes down to the fact that not all terrorist organizations are al-Qaeda, right? Terrorist organizations differ. Their motivations differ. Their ideologies differ. How they actually go about their actions differs. And we've heard a lot about a lot of different ways of defining terrorism, et cetera. But in the popular discourse, al-Qaeda is largely used to define other terrorist organizations. And if those actions don't fit with how we define al-Qaeda, then we're going to have really big issues when it comes to actually combating terrorism, or at least from the public consciousness. We're going to have issues understanding why our actions aren't working, or supporting the correct actions, and I say correct in quotation marks because I don't know what the correct actions are. I'll let Michael offer guesses on that if he wants. I have no idea. But what we have this issue where, especially with Daesh, in the early days as in our data, when we were watching Daesh emerge through these different newspaper articles, it was very interesting to see that in the early days of that, in the first 6 to 8 months of that, it was quite clear that they were treated interchangeably. It was a very one-to-one, that the motivations and the methods of al-Qaeda and the motivations and methods of Daesh were exactly the same. And we saw as we went forward that this conflict with that, because it became more and more obvious that that just wasn't accurate, it wasn't true, that they weren't exactly the same, but they had different methods, they have different motivations. And so, I'm out of time, aren't I? Okay, well...
You're getting a Stolian extension.
I'm getting a Stolian extension. Okay. So we don't know this for a fact. We don't know exactly whether this had an actual implication, but we can raise this question of, if we weren't using al-Qaeda as the frame of reference, would our initial response have been different? And that's where I'm going to leave it. Thank you.
So this is more of a technical question on the coding.
Yes,
and
please.
It's more to be helpful than anything else.
Yes.
So you have al-Qaeda, but half the organizations have the word al-Qaeda in them. So AQI, AQIM, AQIP.
Yes.
So my question was, did you code those separately?
Yes.
From the main core of al-Qaeda?
Yes, we did.
And so for the high numbers you had for the period where you were looking at Daesh, ISIL, whatever, was it the only al-Qaeda mentioned al-Qaeda in Iraq because all the articles say...
No, because al-Qaeda in Iraq was actually coded the same as Daesh.
Perfect. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Very thorough. Why is this man stolen?
The subtitle of your talk is Framing How the Public Interprets and Responds to Terrorism. Would you explain what that means?
It means that we changed what our paper was about. what was the name of the paper again? I'm sorry. I actually don't know what the name of our paper was. Ah. You want to go with that, Michael?
No, we checked.
Yeah, it's sorry about that. We've been working on how to. Yeah, basically, we wanted to actually explore that particular question, and we're like halfway done. So.
Yeah, I often go to conferences with different papers than what the name was when I submitted. So, how many organizations did you guys code for?
I believe that it is, so off the, it's
rough
in the paper.
Rough number.
It's like 68 organizations that we coded for, only 53 of which actually had any mentions, other than a handful that had one mention, which obviously it's very hard to do anything with one mention, so yes.
Okay. Why those 68?
Those were the, for simplicity, we used the State Department official designated terrorist organizations.
Okay. In the future, I would suggest not using the State Department list.
I agree.
Okay, because the State Department list is, you know, if you want to give an example of politically motivated lists of terrorist organizations, they're the kings.
So one thing I would have to say that, first of all, I would love any specific recommendations for other lists. Okay.
Oh, his list.
Yes, I will definitely use your list. No, I assumed that's an acronym.
No. My data is very bad. So.
But I wanted to get to the actual.
So I have a work husband. He does all the work. I come up with the acronyms, and the acronym is Big Allied and Dangerous. But I would suggest picking, and not necessarily using bad. You can use GTD also. Picking some criteria that's not based on the politics of it. It could be the lethality of the organization. It could be the number of incidents of the organization. It could be the target of the organization. Mm-hmm. And using those names of organizations, because I think that might... I don't think your results for Al-Qaeda are going to be different, but I think the moment you get... I mean, Al-Qaeda and ISIS in some ways are like over here,
mm-hmm.
right? But if you get below them, which I strongly hope you guys do, because I think this is a phenomenal project, I think having that different criteria list would be very, very useful.
You know, I would actually be very interested in even just comparing and looking at how those differences occur when we're looking at those different organizations. One thing, though, in defense of using the State Department for this particular study, I would never, for most other studies, I would not recommend ever using it. Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about the U.S. print media.
No, I understand that. There are groups on that list that have never threatened the U.S. I mean, real in terms of some
course.
Of this other stuff.
No, of course. No, I'm just saying, as far as like an easy go-to resource, as far as finding organizations that may be mentioned by the American press, it was hard for us to justify going with, to be fair, we probably will need to explore more organizations other than just those State Department lists. But if we had to pick one just off the top of our heads where it's like, okay, this is U.S. print media, so who should we go to? How about the U.S. government? And they might have, because they're more, as Michael kind of laid out in the front, part of the assumption with this, with the indexing assumption, is that the organizations most likely to be talked about in the U.S. print media are the organizations talked about by the U.S. administration.
Given your argument, just one more point, given your argument, I think if you choose this other criteria, using being on the list as an IV would be really, really interesting.
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
So let me just make 2 points. One is that for this purpose, to explore this, and we used this particular set, remember that the whole set has, I mean, the particular terrorist organizations, the whole set has every article that mentions terrorism.
Right.
Another phase of this, which we haven't gotten to yet, but which we intend to do, is to compare, which has been done in the past, but hasn't been brought up to date, not by us, but by others, is to compare the newspaper stories of which ones appear about which actual attacks that we know that are, for example, in the GTD database, in the ITERET database, and see what the correspondence is. And that will enable us to draw out as well exactly your point in terms of finding these the other issue of which organizations and how different that is from the list that we did for this particular paper. This was just this one cut, particularly to focus, and our intent was to focus on Al-Qaeda in terms of how important Al-Qaeda was as an organization to understand the way that stories about terrorism are presented and what the implications of that might be.
So actually, I want to echo out. First of all, I want to make sure that I wrote to the Senate. So your thought is use the State Department listing as an IV in predicting the frequencies?
Yeah, well, okay. in predicting several different things, but in terms of the importance of the organization,
if you think that the U.S. government is having an impact on who we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
then one would assume that being on the list the U.S. government has made is going to make organizations be reported on more, mm-hmm. even if they're not as lethal, even if they're not as big a threat.
Right.
Okay, that makes complete sense. Okay. So then they'd have to also control for the actual lethality.
Right.
Okay. And then...
While you're thinking about this, in terms of going back to the, which was a surprise to us, the Zipf's Law, right? And you think about the incidence of terrorism over this 2-year period particularly, but over the long stretch, how few actual Al-Qaeda incidents there are, and how dominating, when you start thinking about that log function, how dominating Al-Qaeda is for the distribution. It clearly doesn't mirror the reporting on a particular incident. It's showing something else.
Yeah. Because that was the other thing I wanted to comment on, was we actually, when we found, so we actually only realized the Zipf's Law distribution about 2 weeks ago. And it was mind-blowing to us when we found this. And we actually had to, part of the reason why we were rushing to kind of rework this, because when we found that, it was such a big thing that we kind of felt like we had to include that. We had to talk about that because of the way it worked. Another thing on that, we actually experimented with, okay, so is this just because of, 9/11? Because obviously there was a huge spike in terrorism coverage, the point that we actually had issues with managing just that time period. But we removed the 6 months, starting with 9/11 and on, from the database, just all those articles, and reran it. We had the exact same distribution. So that implies that it's something that has been somewhat more persistent as well. So that's just something I wanted to throw out there. Yeah?
So your argument basically is you look at a lot of the articles that have terrorism in them, we also have the word Al-Qaeda in them. That's the point.
I don't.
After 9/11, the fact that Al-Qaeda comes up a lot is not exactly a shocking revelation.
No, it's not.
And there's no other, if you go to that list of organizations and you ask the State Department to name another organization during that period of time, you'd probably come out with blank faces, much less the American public.
I completely agree with you.
I mean, I'm trying to get at what's the point of the study is what I'm trying to...
Yeah, so the
who's
point of
influencing
this,
who and what?
The point of this Zipfian distribution, it's not that, of course, we expect Al-Qaeda to be the most mentioned. I mean, we actually walked in with it with the assumption, and that's literally all we were looking to do when we first ran this, was just to show it is way more dominant. What we were shocked at was the actual distribution itself. The distribution itself implies much more than just it gets talked about the most. And that's why we actually did this second part of this where we actually looked at that co-occurrence. This isn't a co-occurrence with just terrorism coverage. So Al-Qaeda obviously is the most, when terrorism is brought up, it is the most often discussed. But more importantly, when other organizations are brought up, Al-Qaeda seems to filter its way into those conversations. And when we actually looked at the text, and that was part of the of study two, when we specifically looked at the text of those articles, what we're finding was that Al-Qaeda was predominantly in those articles, and 60% of the time that Al-Qaeda was mentioned, roughly, plus or minus about 2%. When Al-Qaeda is mentioned, it's not because Al-Qaeda was doing something, it's not because the article is about Al-Qaeda, because it's the actions being described are being framed within the understanding that we have of Al-Qaeda. And that was something that that's one of the bigger and more important findings that we have, and that's really what I want to focus on.
But that's what I want to sort of ask. Is it because Al-Qaeda won, or are just journalists just plain lazy? They have no other reference point, so our audience are not that smart, we're not that smart, let's just put Al-Qaeda in here.
I hesitate to say lazy. That's the bigger thing, is that when you're sitting down as a journalist, first of all, you do have time pressures whenever you're writing an article, especially breaking event articles, that you just have to. And so you are going to default back in many of those instances to just whatever your routine is. And if Al-Qaeda is part of your routine when you're writing, then yes. But more importantly is that, and this is something that we talked about a little bit in the article, is that this isn't inherently bad. There are bad implications of this. But what they're providing is a frame of reference that people understand. we understand or feel that we understand who Al-Qaeda is. So if there's something that you don't know who this organization is, you've never heard of this organization, and oftentimes the organization just they forgot to mention the name of the actual organization that conducted the attacks, which was, I thought, somewhat ironic. But what they do instead is, okay, you know what Al-Qaeda looks like, you know what Al-Qaeda does. There are slight differences, and you see that in the framing where they kind of emphasize certain attributes over others when they're being discussed. But it's the question of, okay, you know this organization, so think about this when you're thinking about this action. And that's really what we see going on, is that it's a tool that they're using to try to embed us additional meaning into the article.
But it's a tool the journalists are using, not Al-Qaeda's using.
The journalists.
Yeah.
But yes.
So your earlier explanation was Al-Qaeda appeared. Al-Qaeda shows up. Sorry.
I want, yes.
This is
yes.
Just the text of
okay.
The journalist. It's not the text.
Nothing else.
Right. So Al-Qaeda did not hack the newspapers.
No, okay? Definitely not.
But I think Laura said something interesting, which is it's an indication that Al-Qaeda in some fundamental ways, from a communications perspective, won, right? And I think
Absolutely.
Right. I think that's clearly what it's showing here. And I think the issue of whether they're lazy or not, I think it's more important that we grow to associate certain words with certain other words. And if I asked 100 Americans, what's the first word that comes to your mind when you say terrorism, most of them are going to say either September 11th or Al-Qaeda. So they've won that association in a really strong way. And I think that's a very powerful statement of what you guys are seeing.
The end of your paper, Al-Qaeda won.
Right. Well, so the other element here is if we want to come up with an analogy, and as Rick mentioned, analogies are important, is every newspaper article I read about Republican contenders, whether it's focusing on a specific person or the general thing, the article always ends up being about Trump, right? And in some ways, Al-Qaeda is the Trump of terrorist organizations.
I think that is a very adequate metaphor. No, I'm kidding. I'm entirely kidding.
Right?
I'm entirely kidding.
But if I could, one of the things I want to bring you back to what I was saying at the beginning in terms of this notion of, particularly on terrorist events as well as in is going back, there's a quote. And so a lot of these comments in terms of the framing is not simply, I don't want you to say, leave here with us saying that journalists are lazy. It's that the journalist doing the implicit, they're getting a comment, and they go to a government official to get a comment, and it is more likely that they will get a comment linking that event in some fashion out of the words of the government official will be Al-Qaeda. It's not, and so they'll report that, which enters our database. So it's not 100,000 words that we have 100 articles in which Al-Qaeda could appear many more times out of many different mouths in terms of that.
And you control for duplication that the same official gave the same interview to the Boston Globe and the New
York
Times?
Because we're only looking at two newspapers.
The Wall Street Journal.
So what if the same official just keeps repeating the same spiel?
Well, that's actually kind of important and interesting. So it's not something I think that they do that. And that's actually, for the purpose of what we just did, not something we would control for, because
right.
It's actually part of the finding.
Or let's say, because I've seen this where I've said something, and then it just gets repeated. I didn't say it 15 times. I may have said it once, and it's repeated 15 times. So that is something that you can look for. You can cross the tab it.
Oh, yeah, no, and that's definitely something that in the next part of the study that we'll definitely explore. Thankfully, though, in the current analysis, we're limited to two newspapers, so that risk of that is, relatively speaking, moderated.
What feel we have to have
a journalist in the room? We have two other people waiting over here.
We have time for one more.
Okay.
Being a journalist, I don't want to take responsibility for all the stupidities out there.
I'm
in
not
journalism,
blaming you.
But I think it is relevant to point out that, I mean, journalistic writing is a little less idea-based, and, you know, when you have to write an article about the IMU in Uzbekistan or something, I mean, there's pressure to also bring up what's going on with Al-Qaeda, and I don't know if, it'd be interesting, I don't know how you can filter out that factor, but just the fact that Al-Qaeda appears in an article while you're writing about other terror groups, I don't think is always necessarily implying an equivalency in the mind of a journalist.
No, I think that is a very true statement. And I don't, and I want to emphasize, I don't think that we're not trying to say anything about the journalist's cognition. I mean, that's not in any way, shape, or form what we're trying to do with this. Instead, what it's basically saying, so part of the reason we did this, we have the second part of this, where we, I guess technically third part, but whatever, research question two, is to explore those actual, those uses. And I think that the point Michael brings up is fair. It's not necessarily the journalists that are coming up with this. Journalists are just people. Journalists get the same information from the same people. They're getting it from people coming down from above. They have to make quick decisions. It's basically, and when you're in that time crunch, you have to try to convey that information as best as you can. And sometimes your editor wants you to mention Al-Qaeda. And so it's our question is, okay, so when Al-Qaeda is mentioned, what is that doing in the text? What might that be doing? And that's really the question that we're trying to explore with that.
Yes, Cynthia, one last question, please. Quickly, yes. Quick response as well
there. Thank you. You know, Zipf's law applies to a lot of things, not just words.
It
applies to cities. It applies to orders, sometimes on the Internet, in various companies. And it has a predictive function as well. So how do you use it, or how are you thinking about using it in terms of predicting either word use, topic, or other kind understanding of other kinds of content, coverage of terrorism?
So that's an interesting question, because it depends on what you mean by the predictive function. So usually when I hear that it has a predictive function, what it's basically saying, it's predictive in as much as you can predict the frequency based on its frequency rank.
Yeah, so it's such a regular pattern.
Yes.
That should you discover segments of that pattern, you may be able to predict the entire distribution.
That is correct. So, for instance, one thing to point out, so this is the quick graph. We explain almost entirely all of the variants. Even when we look at, so this is, right, we have two R-squares, one R-square where it's all the organizations, one R-square where it's just the organizations that have at least 10 mentions, which is kind of common for ZipFi, and it kind of breaks down at the lower ends. But what you're seeing is, either way, 99% of the variants or 93% of the variants. And so basically that is showing that it is predictive. So we can basically say, based on this, that we may have some gaps in what organizations we're looking at, but they're going to fit somewhere in that ZipFi distribution, and that's going to predict how often they're going to be brought up. Yes.
Cool. Right. Thank you very much, Ben and Michael.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real honor to be here. I'm very appreciative of the invitation, and it's been a fascinating day, and I've really enjoyed all your perspectives. The last 5 or 6 years, I've been heavily engaged, actually, with trying to conceptualize terrorism, culminating in this book with OUP on the subject. I'm shamelessly drawing attention to it, but it is just out in time for the Christmas market, and probably just small enough for a stocking filler, so, you know, it could be an entertaining Christmas morning. But the reasons I wrote the book are various. Of course, there have always been policy-making reasons for trying to define what it is that you're trying to respond to in order to generate international cooperation, which is seen as crucial in responding to terrorism. And I think another reason, particularly in the post-9/11 world, is that the word terrorism has been used very carelessly, very widespreadly, you know, even to the point where Julian Assange was described by Senator McConnell as a high-tech terrorist, whether the Israeli attack on the flotilla of ships was terrorism, drone strikes, etc., etc. The point is there's not been any real rigorous analysis as to what we mean by terrorism. And I think the post-9/11 world, this has almost been exacerbated, even if it was difficult before 9/11. Academic reasons as well. Terrorism, to put it harshly, has been seen as something that's in its theory stage. I think there is a need for sustainable theory building as to what terrorism is. And I think it's not good enough, really, just to sort of talk about, well, whatever the latest mode of activity that Al-Qaeda is doing or ISIS is doing, we can call that terrorism. I think the point really is that you establish the criteria very carefully as to what you think constitutes an act of terrorism. And if the particular act of violence satisfies that criteria, then it is an act of terrorism. Well, whoever actually perpetrator. There's no point just calling everything that Al-Qaeda does or ISIS does as terrorism. I also think it's important because, of course, all other terrorism-related theories are contingent on what you mean by terrorism in the first place, and that includes the causes of terrorism, disengagement from terrorism, and so on. One sort of perhaps slightly more personal reason for doing it, as you probably know from the mid-2000s, we've had the development of the discourse of radicalization in the United Kingdom. It's a very prominent discourse. I've been quite skeptical of it. And being skeptical of the radicalization discourse, I've thought, well, okay, well, let's revisit terrorism, because actually radicalization probably gives terrorism a good name as far as trying to conceptualize something is concerned. Having said that, terrorism is a social construction. So there is something of a paradox in trying to be definitive about it. So, for example, if we claim that terrorism, the word terrorism has been abused in the post-9/11 world, then those people who are claiming that it's been abused are themselves culpable of making some kind of knowledge claim as to what terrorism is or what terrorism is not. I don't think that means, notwithstanding the social construction of terrorism, I don't think that means that we can't generate some sort of agreement as to what terrorism is at a given time in a contemporary context. And I think it's fair to say in the academic literature of the past 50 years now, actually, there has been some consensus as to what terrorism is. And that revolves around its psychological dimension. Namely, terrorism is the intent to generate a psychological impact beyond the immediate victims. The immediate victims are not the intended recipients of the terrorist message. Now, in the book, I've made three preliminary assumptions when we're approaching the definition of terrorism, or if you like, a slightly softer term, conceptualization of terrorism. And the first is that there is no such thing as an act of violence that is in and of itself terrorist. There's no such thing as an act of violence that is in and of itself inherently terrorist. The implications of that, of course, that it doesn't actually help us to have a whole list of different types of violent acts. That doesn't actually help us capture or get any closer to what terrorism is. So, for example, all the UN conventions, which are obviously tackling different types of terrorist acts, although this wasn't their original purpose, doesn't actually get us closer to what we mean by terrorism. The second preliminary assumption that I make when we approach the conceptualization of terrorism is that, and this isn't new, it's best viewed, when we come to defining it, as a particular method of political violence, rather than conceptualized as inherent to any particular ideology or cause. Now, the implications of this is that if you see terrorism as a method, it could be a whole variety of actors that use that method of terrorism. And we discussed this earlier today, haven't we, where it could be terrorist organizations, it could be extreme fringes of social movements, it could be guerrilla organizations, it could be states. The idea is you're defining the activity of terrorism. Therefore, I think, as Leonard Weinberg so rightly wrote some time ago now, this whole dichotomy of one man's terrorism as another's freedom fighter confuses the goal with the activity. If we don't think there's anything distinctive about terrorism, then the terrorism freedom fighter dichotomy says everything we need to know. If we don't think there's anything distinctive about terrorism as a form of political violence. If we do think there's something distinctive about terrorism analytically that we can theorize about, then the terrorism freedom fighter, as I said, confuses the goal with the activity. So Yasser Arafat was wrong when he said the reason one is a terrorist or not depends on the cause for whom that person is fighting. The third assumption I make is that combatants and non-civilians can also be victims of terrorism. I think because I focus on a purpose-based definition, I don't see why combatants and non-civilians cannot also be victims of terrorism, providing the intention is to generate a psychological impact beyond those immediate victims, and providing you have broader audiences through which to communicate that message. And in questions, perhaps, you know, we might have a look at one or two examples if there's time. So those are the three assumptions. And the other thing I've been doing, actually, is to sort of look at UK counterterrorism strategy, and we heard Prevent mentioned earlier, and how conceptualizations of terrorism and terrorism militia square with a characterization of a terrorist threat in the United Kingdom recently. Now, sort of within this discourse of the emergence of radicalization, we had Prevent, of course, the contest strategy is what it's known as in the UK, with the four Ps, that's pursue, protect, prepare, and prevent. In many ways, Prevent has been the most controversial issue. Initially, it became embroiled to do with agendas to do with social cohesion, social integration, and so on, so that these very broad issues became securitized. It was very much criticized as spying on communities. Now, within this discourse of radicalization, I think there was some confusion as to what was really meant by the term. Did radicalization mean violent radicalization? Just that? Did it mean those people, were people radicalized if they sympathized as to why people became violent? Were people radicalized if they disagreed with the use of violence in the United Kingdom but sympathized with the Taliban? Were you radicalized if you wanted elements of Sharia law or had some sympathy with the caliphate by peaceful means? It was very unclear, indeed, for a few years as to what was really meant by radicalization. And many chief constables, actually, a few chief constables, confided to me that they did not really know what was meant by radicalization that they were supposed to respond to. There was a revised Prevent version in 2011. And this did draw itself in from the integration agenda and the societal cohesion agenda. But what it did do was much more explicitly say that we are interested in ideological thought. We're focusing on ideological thought as well as the violent methods that might be used to pursue that thought. And they came out with what I thought was a very, very controversial term, which is non-violent but extremist ideology that is conducive to terrorism. Now, most of us who have studied terrorism for a few years would think that's something of a paradox, because terrorism has traditionally been seen as ineluctably about violence or the threat of violence. If a non-violent ideology is culpable for terrorism in any way, then it ceases to become non-violent. So what I think we've seen in the United Kingdom is the merging of the discourses of terrorism and radicalization, and now, more recently, terrorism, radicalization, and extremism. Now, this has taken place, admittedly, in quite a dramatic shift in the structure of terrorism that I think we're all familiar with. They haven't quite gone, because we have the dissident Republican threat in Northern Ireland still, where you have this threshold of joining a terrorist group. So arguably it's easier for the security forces to keep tabs on people that look like they're going to join a terrorist organization or they're already part of a terrorist organization. Now, of course, the government is trying to intervene at the earliest possible stage in the trajectories of those who they fear might resort to terrorism. And leading to one think tank arguing in the United Kingdom that the whole Muslim population therefore becomes suspect because they don't know where to start. So this is in the context of not just a sort of a broader concern in terms of a focus on non-violent but extremist ideological thought, but also a longitudinal concern by trying to intervene at an earlier stage into the trajectory of terrorism. Nevertheless, I think this focus on non-violent ideology that's said to be conducive to terrorism blurs, I think, the very important distinction between extremism of thought and extremism of method. And there are also practical consequences of this. For example, the government refuses now to engage with people who deplore the use of violence but hold to their non-violent extremist ideology. I think it's an unhelpful counter-terrorism conundrum when you include perhaps quite large sections of the population who deplore the methods of Al-Qaeda, deplore the methods of ISIS, but hold to this ideology because they are seen nevertheless as part of the terrorist problem. And I'm not sure that's a very prudent path to go down. So the concern really is that counter-terrorism in the United Kingdom is actually becoming counter-ideological and therefore itself more ideological. And I think, therefore, you're taking the focus of what counter-terrorism should really be about away, and that is on countering terrorism. If you look at the attacks, Tunisia, Paris, the Woolwich attack in the UK, you know, really, the onus is on the state to use every possible means at its disposal to try and prevent acts of terrorism. But because I think counter-terrorism has become more ideological, we are missing a trick in not engaging with those who abhor violent methods but hold to extremist ideology. And to add a caveat to that, this does not mean in any way that you're endorsing that ideology. Of course not. But there are other fora outside counterterrorism for tackling undemocratic ideologies, not least the ballot box every 4 or 5 years. And on this subject of blurring the distinction between extremism of method and extremism of thought, I think this is also tellingly evident in the United Kingdom's definition of extremism, which you'll find at the back of its contest documents, its prevent documents. And its definition is vocal of extremism, vocal or active opposition to fundamental British values, including democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty, and mutual respect and tolerance of different faiths and beliefs. If you look at this definition, therefore, peaceful activity itself becomes extremist if it is in support of an extremist ideology or belief system. While conversely, this definition of extremism excludes extremist activity if it is carried out in the cause of a non-extremist doctrine. So, for example, if you carry out acts of terrorism for a nationalist cause, perhaps remarkably, it escapes this definition of extremism. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.